From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. It was about this time last year that the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed here in the U.S. A year later, on his first day in office, President Biden is signing 10 executive orders focused on boosting testing, vaccines, and medical supplies. And joining us now is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson with more. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Tanya.
What is the Biden team saying about the fact that testing and supplies are still a major concern 1 year after the first coronavirus case was confirmed here? I mean, Biden's medical advisor, Michael Osterholm, is telling us that there was no vaccine plan left by the Trump administration.
That's what we're hearing from the incoming Biden administration. Jeff Zients, who's the COVID czar for Joe Biden, said what we're inheriting from Trump is much worse than we could have imagined. We have to start from scratch. And apparently, there was not only no vaccine plan, but they didn't make enough vaccines. Recently, the Trump administration adjusted the guidelines, said you should give to states, you should give the vaccine to more people, 65 and up, they suggested, but they didn't give states enough doses to keep up with the new demand.
Well, starting from scratch. So the Biden team says he's authorizing federal agencies to invoke the Defense Production Act to speed up the production of supplies specifically. President Trump also did that, too, we had heard. How would these new actions change things?
Well, the Biden team says the Defense Production Act has a lot of parts. It's planning to use it to boost supply chains. It's going to try to increase testing, increase supplies like syringes and masks, but also the production of vaccines. They seem very confident that they can get enough supply into the system of vaccines and then solve the distribution problem. They're also going to establish a federal board to increase coronavirus testing capacity and access. And they've got a whole bunch of other plans. As you said, he's signing 10 executive orders today, Joe Biden, to boost the production of vaccines. And that should change things. The biggest difference is the federal government is going to be much more involved, much more hands-on. As Joe Biden himself said, we're going to manage the hell out of this virus. That's something that the Trump administration didn't do.
Okay, 100 million vaccines in his first 100 days. Biden is also setting new rules on mask wearing and travel. What's notable there?
He is asking people to mask up for 100 days. He has said that he will have a mask mandate. He's already signed that order for the federal government. Any properties that are operated by the federal government, people will have to wear a mask there. That's a mask mandate. He can't make the states have mandates, but he is encouraging them to do that. And several red states where mask wearing is a political issue and people think that wearing a mask is somehow a sign of being a liberal wimp, several red states have already started mask mandates. So that should make a difference.
All of these plans, of course, require money. And the Biden team is saying the president wants to convince Republicans to get on board with this $1.9 trillion plan to pay for this and to help people and businesses in need. But that's going to take time. Is that going to hamper his pandemic response, having to really convince Republicans to get on board?
Well, he can do a lot by himself, and he will do a lot on his own. That's what executive orders are. But he does need money to pay for certain things. He wants to reimburse states, for instance, for the cost of involving the National Guard. There's a lot of things that he wants from Congress. It's not only going to take a long time, it's not clear if he's going to get Republicans to cooperate. Mm-hmm. Republicans are generally fine with increasing the deficit to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy, but they have been balking at sending $1,400 checks to individual people because of the cost. So, yes, that's going to be a big lift, but Biden is still going to go full steam ahead. He thinks there's a lot he can do on his own.
Before I let you go, Mara, I want to talk to you a little bit about what it's been like to interact with this new administration. We heard from the new press secretary last night and today. There were a couple of press briefings. What's the tone this administration is setting?
Well, the tone the administration is trying to set is that they're going to provide accurate, honest information to the press. Some of that is going to, as Jen Psaki said yesterday, will be hard to hear, might be unpleasant information. She doesn't promise that she'll get along with the press all the time. But the fact that they are going to have briefings every day in and of itself is a huge change. I think we went almost a year or more without a single briefing from the Trump administration. So they want to rebuild trust with the American people. And I don't know if we have time to play this bite from Jen yesterday.
We don't.
But this is what she said.
Oh, yeah. But thank you so much for your reporting. This is Mara Liasson. She's NPR's national political correspondent.
Well, this is President Biden's first day. On former President Trump's last day, yesterday, there was a flurry of pardons, making it more than 140 this week. And according to Washington Post analysis, almost a third of them had a link to Trump or people in his orbit. David Farenthold is one of a team of Post reporters. And David, you found a former Trump fundraiser who was convicted of then later lobbying the Trump administration on behalf of China. There were rappers. We'll take that up elsewhere in the program. And there was former White House guru Steve Bannon charged with taking money from hundreds of thousands of donors through a sham charity, lying, saying it was going to build the wall. It was not. You report that yesterday Trump kept asking people if he should pardon Bannon. What happened?
Yeah, he had been weighing this. And the important thing to know is just how divorced the process of deciding on Bannon's pardon was from the normal decision-making you make about a pardon, which is, does this person deserve mercy? Is this person remorseful? Have they repented from their crime? Ben hasn't even gone to trial for his charge yet. And there was none of that sort of mercy, you know, remorse calculation. Basically, this was Trump deciding whether Bannon had been nice enough to him to deserve a pardon. Bannon had said some bad things about him a couple years ago. He'd been more on his side recently as he sought to overturn the election. Basically, did Bannon deserve it, not as a good person or a bad person, but as a friend of Trump?
Well, and by the way, there's also an office that's supposed to, you know, help people with the pardons. It filters through there. That didn't seem to happen here. And so Steve Bannon became one of at least six people that Trump pardoned who had either yet to face trial or hadn't started their sentences. And it seemed to be on this whim of noblesse oblige, you know, should I do him this favor? He also commuted the sentence of an eye doctor in West Palm Beach, Florida, accused of stealing $73 million from Medicare. There was a pardon for an ally of Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who'd been convicted of wire fraud. He'd already pardoned Kushner's father. You do make the case that a lot of this was return favors.
That's right. There was also a guy who owns an entire floor of Trump Tower, who was a tenant of Trump Tower, and somebody who was a longtime member of Trump's golf club in Westchester County, New York, and a donor to Trump's foundation. So a lot of these folks are people who had either direct or indirect connections to Trump, and the logic for granting them a pardon seemed to be no greater than, well, they've been good to Trump, and Trump can do this for them.
Well, last-minute pardons are not unusual, though. Clinton, then-President Bill Clinton, made 140, including Mark Rich, who was a convicted tax evader who'd made large donations to Democratic causes. That seems tame compared to some of these crimes that you've just outlined. But at that time, Republicans launched an investigation into Clinton's pardons.
That's right. That was an enormous deal. It defined Bill Clinton's legacy for years afterward. So the question here is not whether Trump did something unprecedented. I think he did sort of what Clinton did and more. History judged Clinton quite harshly for that. And the question now is whether this will affect Trump's legacy and what people will see Trump in a different light, that he used the last measure of his power basically to do favors for his friends.
Well, these were, swamp creatures, many of them. And President Trump had said he was going to clear the swamp. It's one thing, you know, Democrats seem to want to hit the ground running on things like COVID-19 and not more investigations. But there is Trump's second impeachment trial. And there's also talk of a 2024 run. Are you saying that these pardons might impact those two events?
It couldn't impact either event. One thing we should say is that pardon power is pretty absolute. In the Constitution, presidents can grant pardons to whoever they want for whatever reasons they want. So I don't think there's anything that we've heard about that says these pardons are illegal. Certainly, they could come up in an impeachment trial as evidence of, you know, bad behavior by Trump. It could be brought up again in a 2024 election if Trump runs again. I think Trump left under such a cloud with so many crises happening at once and the attack on the Capitol on January 6th sort of overshadowing all of it. This probably will not dominate the discussion about his legacy the way Clinton's pardons did his, But Clinton's legacy also, in the end, was much stronger. He was seen in hindsight as a much better president than Trump is seen now.
Well, people are already speaking out, at least about one notable pardon, and that was of Kwame Kilpatrick, former mayor of Detroit, charged for a number of things, and pretty much stealing money from Detroiters through racketeering, extortion. He's only served 7 years of his 28-year sentence. People in Detroit are outraged. Why did Trump pardon him?
That is such a mystery, because Kilpatrick is a Democrat, obviously. He had done all these horrible things. He has no connection to Trump that we know of. But it seemed that Kilpatrick in recent years had become a big fan of Trump, written him letters saying how great he was. And it maybe that was all. But one of our reporters talked to the U.S. attorney who had prosecuted Kilpatrick and who was outraged that this man had been let out of prison early after such a long investigation and such wide evidence of wrongdoing.
David Farenthold, part of a team of reporters for The Washington Post, who took a look at now former President Trump's pardons. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Pfizer just announced it feels its coronavirus vaccine protects against the new variant. That's good news. But it will take over 200 million people being vaccinated to get to herd immunity in the U.S. That's when the virus begins to run out of hosts. Let's bring in UCLA epidemiologist Anne Ramoyne. And Dr. Ramoyne, you say we have to be careful talking about immunity. For instance, a new study published in the journal Science followed 200 patients who'd survived COVID-19, concluded most had immunity for 8 months. But we don't know if that means forever.
You're absolutely right. We still really don't have a good grasp of how this virus works in all populations. And immune response can vary tremendously from one person to the next. I think that the key here is we know that there is some immunity that is conferred from having a natural infection, but the levels of immune reactivity and what level of protection actually exist are not yet clear.
And there's a cautionary note in the study. It says about 10% of people see their immune systems degrade. But before we move on to vaccinations, what we seem to know is that there are false claims about immunity after having had COVID-19. You have the Republican Senator Rand Paul, who had COVID-19 and claims that it is more effective than a vaccine. He says it's 99.999 effective in granting immunity. Just your thoughts for a second on people pushing actually the idea that you get COVID-19 because it confers better immunity than a vaccine.
We absolutely do not have data to suggest that immunity from infection is actually better than immunity from a vaccine. And in fact, immunity from a vaccine is a much safer way to get immunity and a much more responsible way to get it. Getting immunity through a natural infection comes along with potential for a long hauler syndrome, with the potential for very severe disease, with the potential for death, and with the potential to be able to pass that virus on to somebody else, being part of a chain of transmission.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to vaccines. The Pfizer and Moderna two-dose vaccines are now being administered, we know, said to provide over 90% immunity to people who get both the doses. We hear you might get a little bit of immunity after the first, but what happens after the second? Do we know how long it takes for immunity to kick in? Is it full immunity?
So you get the first dose, and then with Pfizer, for example, you're going to wait 3 weeks and you'll get your booster. Approximately 7 days after that booster is when we anticipate you may reach full immunity for Pfizer. For Moderna, you get vaccinated, you have your second dose 28 days later, and then another 14 days until you reach optimal immunity.
And, of course, here's the kabillion-dollar question, given, you know, how much money has been poured into getting these shots to the public. How long does it last?
Well, this is, again, a question that we do not have answers to as of yet. Recently, Moderna suggested that the vaccines that they had delivered would potentially provide protection up to a year, but there's so many factors that are going to impact this, including how this virus continues to mutate over time.
Viruses are always mutating and changing. It would take a lot of mutations to override the vaccine. But then we're hearing of, you know, rogue variants. So what, if any, concerns do you have right now about mutations?
Well, I think it's very important that we be monitoring mutations and following this very closely. This is something that could have an impact on how well these vaccines protect us against COVID-19. You know, these variants do not appear to be problematic for the vaccine, but to me, this is just a warning. Listen, we really need to be watching this. The coronavirus vaccine could become an annual vaccine where we need boosters or to be able to maintain immunity, or that the vaccine needs to be changed a little to be able to provide protection against any new variants or strains that are circulating.
But we heard from Dr. Peter Hotez that the vaccine could be fighting within your blood cells to fight off the virus, but you may still be walking around with some virus in your nose and you may be able to infect other people. Is that true, that once you're vaccinated, you may not get sick, but you could still make other people sick?
We still don't know the extent to which vaccination affects transmission. Most vaccines at least reduce transmission of the pathogen that the vaccine is targeting, but we really do need to understand whether or not vaccination is going to protect against asymptomatic infection and whether or not a vaccine protects us from being able to spread this virus asymptomatically to others.
Yeah, you may not get sick. You don't have symptoms, but you could spread it to somebody else. Right. You know, we'll still be wearing masks and social distancing for a while, even after vaccination.
Absolutely. I think you hit upon something really important here, though. You started to talk about herd immunity, and I think that people don't really understand that one of the aims of working towards herd immunity is to keep vulnerable groups who can't get vaccinated safe. And this is really important. We want to make sure that everybody that can get vaccinated does get vaccinated so that the people who cannot get vaccinated are still safe.
Thank you, Dr. Ramoine. That's a UCLA epidemiologist, Anne Ramoine.
Snowfall in the Mountain West is way below normal so far this season, making it likely that drought will continue in places like Colorado. So the state is urging farmers and ranchers there to prepare for some dry times ahead. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Saka spoke with some young ranchers who are learning techniques that can help them adapt to drought while also fighting climate change.
On a pasture outside of Steamboat Springs, rancher Matthew Gordon bends down and grabs a handful of grass. His wife Mandy watches and chuckles over his excitement.
What's happening here is really super cool because we have like several layers of organic matter built up on top of this ground. But underneath, even now, during this cold time, I can see new grass growing.
Cattle helped build up this layer. Their hooves trample down grass and their own waste, makes for good compost.
And also then provides a cover for the ground, a blanket, insulation, which is able to also help store water and keep the soil temperature cooler.
Matthew and Mandy are nerds for this kind of stuff. They listen to podcasts, watch YouTube videos, and take classes on ways to manage land in more natural and sustainable ways. They've worked on other ranches, but now they're taking all that information and starting their own operation in the middle of a historic drought and a changing climate.
I see water kind of going away, and that can be a little scary. And through, you know, a lot of our practices, by helping promote healthier soil, it helps the water infiltrate and stay on the land instead of running off.
A conventional rancher will turn cattle out onto a pasture for several weeks or months, but that can lead to overgrazing and major damage to the land, especially during a drought. So the Gordons use portable electric fences to keep their cattle moving, mimicking how predators chase herd animals around.
Whether it be elk or bison that used to be on an area for a short period of time, consuming that one bite or two of the vegetation, and they would move. And that's when the magic happens of the recovery period.
Since there's still something left of that grass, it can use photosynthesis to regrow. Through that process, the plant captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and pumps it down into the soil through a healthy root system.
Carbon capture is kind of a buzzword these days, and they're trying to develop technologies to do it when, you know, this is a technology that we've had forever.
Industrial farming techniques like intensive tillage, animal feedlots, and the use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides have done a lot of damage to soil ecosystems worldwide. Nicole Savita is the Sustainable Food Systems Specialization Lead at the University of Colorado Boulder.
What existed before we started plowing up the prairies was this really, really complex, rich ecosystem. We took, you know, what had developed over millennia and had been really well managed by indigenous communities and destroyed it all very, very quickly to our own peril.
Regenerative agriculture is considered an important climate solution. It has the potential to draw down a lot of carbon. While more farmers and ranchers are adopting these techniques, they make up a small number overall. Savita says it's just not what most producers know.
There's a knowledge gap that we need to bridge because we have been farming in agrochemically intensive ways for a long time.
It can also take some convincing that it works.
It's understandable that a farmer would say, like, yeah, I just can't take the risk in abandoning what I know.
And it takes time to reap the benefits.
It's not as though a farmer can stop farming in a more conventional way tomorrow and suddenly the soil is magically healed.
But Savita says the efforts can help farmers adapt to climate change and make more money. Cindy Lair is with the Colorado Department of Agriculture. She says profitability is the key to making this type of farming popular.
If it's not going to help make good business sense to a farmer or rancher, they're really not going to be interested in doing this.
But some farmers and ranchers might need financial support to make the shift. Colorado has created a soil health program to help, but there's no state funding for it yet. For now, the program is funded by a $5 million partnership with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The Gordons got a microloan from a local nonprofit to help them start. Matthew says one of the biggest challenges is convincing other farmers and ranchers to give regenerative agriculture a shot.
Inherently, the farming and ranching community attracts very tough, hard-headed people, and that's what makes them good and what makes them resilient.
The Gordons want to reshape that rugged mindset for a changing climate. For them, that means learning to adapt so their ranch can change too. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sakis in Denver.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management. Jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
President Biden campaigned on uniting the country. He now takes office just weeks after a pro-Trump insurrection. The NPR Politics podcast is there every day to break down the transition of power as Biden takes the reins in Washington.
We have another reminder today about the havoc the pandemic is having on the U.S. economy and people's lives. About 900,000 Americans filed for unemployment last week for the first time, and that growing number brings into stark focus the challenges ahead for President Biden. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, for more. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
So last week's unemployment claims were down slightly from the week before, but it still remains elevated. And when you look at continuing claims, which counts people who have received unemployment benefits for at least 2 weeks, that number continued to decline. So help put all of this into perspective for us.
So that continuing claims number, what it measures is people on state unemployment programs in each of the 50 states. And those benefits don't last forever. For most states, they last 26 weeks. So that drop off in the number of continuing claims is simply largely the result of people exhausting those 26 weeks of benefits. Now, there is a different federal emergency program that was passed because of the pandemic, in which you, if you exhaust those benefits, you can get another 24 weeks of assistance from the federal government. And Tanya, there's still 3 million, more than 3 million people filing continuing claims under that program. So it's still a very acute problem with unemployment in this country.
Right. And you're talking about this coronavirus relief package, right, in December that included more assistance for people who lost their jobs. What kind of impact, though, is that having for people who are newly unemployed?
Well, so the big thing is it provides an additional $300 a week, known as the federal enhancement to state unemployment payments. So basically an extra $300 a week. For many people, though, it's even more fundamental. This bill passed in December simply allows a lot of gig workers and self-employed people to actually file for and collect unemployment benefits when previously, before the pandemic, they were not eligible if you were a sort of a gig worker, self-employed type of person. So that's another sort of benefit of the bill passed in December is that it allows gig workers to continue to file for unemployment claims because that the original program under the CARES Act was set to expire in December. And that bill passed in December itself actually extended those programs for the people that need them.
Yeah, Biden is proposing this $1.9 trillion relief package going before Congress really soon. What's the latest on that front?
Yeah, it's clear it's not going to sail right through Congress easily. There's been several Republican senators, even the moderates like Mitt Romney, who are sort of pushing back on the $1.9 trillion price tag and questioning if the timing is right since they did just pass a stimulus measure in December. So there's a lot of talk about sort of the congressional leaders and the White House getting together in the coming days to kind of debate and hash out what exactly we'll have a chance of getting through Congress of that $1.9 trillion package.
Right. Besides another infusion of cash, there's so much more on Biden's economic agenda that he will likely have to take up and talk through with Congress. That's Mike Rehan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. As always, thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, Tanya.
We all know COVID-19 has put a huge strain on frontline healthcare workers, but Mass General Hospital and the New England Conservatory here in Boston have teamed up to give those workers a bit of a respite. The Boston Hope Music Teaching Project pairs doctors working with COVID-19 patients with NEC teaching fellows for music lessons. Luther Warren gave a viola lesson to Dr. Kathy May Tran over Zoom.
The consistency of the bow stroke is very important. So whatever speed, you know, you don't want it to change contact point or speed or angle or anything like that. But just to keep kind of one sound.
And Dr. Tran and teacher Luther Warren join us now. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
And I got to say, Dr. Tran, we were thinking, wow, she is good. But we understand that you had studied viola and violin when you were younger. You gave it up for over a decade. How tough has it been? And what is it to hold a violin again?
Well, first of all, I'm flattered. That's very, very kind of you. And I have to credit Luther for bringing me back up to speed. A decade away from my instruments had kind of left me with a space in my heart that was empty, and I didn't really know why. But coming back to music has been a great joy for me to be able to have a moment of peace and concentration that I usually don't have in my busy life.
Right. Let's listen to a little of the meditation from the opera Thais by Massenet. This is what you're playing in your lesson. And we'll hear a little, and then maybe you can tell us what's happening there as you're playing. Let's listen.
As I hear it, I actually feel all this emotion too. So it's playing it, it's hearing it, it's feeling it. There's so much that in my work and in my life that I can't say. And I think through this music, you know, during these lessons that we have together and during my practice, it's my way of expressing myself. It's my way of funneling all of that energy that I feel that I can't usually share into music. This piece is particularly special to me for many reasons, and to be able to navigate those emotions too on top of, you know, what I'm feeling at work and the pandemic, it's a gift to have this creative outlet. It really is.
Well, you've shared with us this was your mom's favorite piece.
Yeah, this was my mom's favorite piece. My brother actually played this piece for her, and he learned it because it was her favorite piece, and he would play it for her all the time. And she sadly passed away from colon cancer 6 years ago. And I remember sitting when she was on hospice, sitting next to her bed, and she passed away. And that was a time where I didn't know how to navigate my own emotions. I remember sitting there in shock. And my brother, as vividly as it was yesterday, I remember this. He stood up and walked over and picked up his violin, and he played this piece for her just minutes after she passed away.
Well, it's just so powerful. And I just, how much, you can't talk about it because you have patient confidentiality. You're a doctor. But I'm imagining you're seeing death. You're seeing COVID-19 death.
This is very true. And the death that we see is not families surrounded by the people who love them the most. It's families waiting on Zoom and watching and not knowing what to do, not knowing what they're seeing. It's patients who are passing away alone without their family members, but with only doctors and nurses and therapists to be by their side. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's the hardest part. And then Luther Warren, here you enter the picture to give lessons. I mean, imagining that, first of all, the pandemic has been hard on somebody who gives music lessons because, you know, the social distancing, and I'm sure people just aren't doing what they once did. But were you at all nervous, or is this a chance to, you know, be a part of something? We all feel like we wish we could volunteer at hospitals. We wish we could do, but we can't. There's nothing we could do.
Absolutely. I think that even in the best of times, classical musicians' life can feel very isolating. It's a very small community of people that are very obsessively practicing an art form, which has undeniably lost a lot of relevance to the broader world in the past decades. And especially when this pandemic hit last March, you know, I think a lot of us were just looking around feeling completely helpless, as everyone was, but also our professional life virtually vanished overnight. And so when I heard about this project, it was just such an amazingly clear opportunity to be able to contribute positively to the pandemic response. And that was something I was really grateful to be able to explore. But it also gave my own work a meaning that even at the best of times, it can be difficult to find that meaning in my work.
Yeah. For those of us who think music teachers are so valuable, I'm glad you're being validated with that. I'm wondering too, Luther, this is a wide program. There are a lot of people involved in this. I'm wondering if some of your other teachers are saying, oh, you got someone who actually can play. I mean, there are probably people just starting.
I don't think that the level of experience, previous experience, actually is so important. I think it has much more to do with the willingness to be very analytical, to be constantly seeking for perfection, to be constantly trying to better yourself. That's a lot of what it takes to study music effectively. And I think that those are qualities that clinicians tend to have in spades. No matter what the level of experience is for the healthcare workers that are coming into this project, everyone has just been so floored by the dedication and the professionalism, even in this work, which is, it's not at all what their primary profession and their primary concerns are.
Yeah. Dr. Tran, Kathy Mae Tran, I'm wondering, and I hope this isn't inappropriate, but I'm thinking of what you've described, you know, your brother playing for your mom right after she died. And then you also said you were watching, you and other doctors watch COVID-19 patients die alone without their family. Have you ever thought of bringing the violin in?
Oh, for sure. For patients? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. As an extension of this program or as an evolution, we've been participating in a program at Mass General Hospital called Virtual Bedside Concerts. And the idea is to bring in music for patients who are isolated. So it's a treatment for loneliness. So many of the teaching fellows, including Luther, participate in that. For special concerts, we invite family members. So it's a little private concert, a time of togetherness in which we can share the gifts that these amazing teaching fellows have. These hugely relevant gifts, I would like to add, Luther. Yeah. These hugely valuable, relevant gifts to patients.
Dr. Tran, thank you so much.
Of course. I'm happy to be here and happy to share.
And Luther, thank you so much as well for your good work. Thank you.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
That's Luther Warren, a teacher at the New England Conservatory. And we're also speaking to Dr. Kathy May Tran, a doctor at Mass General Hospital, speaking about the Boston Hope Music Teaching Project. It's just one of Boston Hope's programs. We'll tell you about more at hearandnow.org.
You know, all of those fashions we saw at the inauguration, they were created by some up-and-coming fashion designers. And today, those designers are still basking in the spotlight. Every 4 years, fashion critics break down what the First Lady wears to the big event. And Layla Ilchi, a trending news reporter for Women's Wear Daily, says this year it's especially important to look at the messages these fashion moments convey.
Obviously, this year was different because it's the first time that we have a female vice president, and obviously, as much as this is such a historic moment and some people think that we shouldn't be paying attention to fashion, like fashion always conveys a message. There's always kind of a statement there, and especially with women in politics and suffragettes.
Vice President Kamala Harris wore a custom purple suit by Christopher John Rogers, a young Black designer who Ilchi describes as this moment's fashion darling. It's also been reported Harris chose purple as a nod to Shirley Chisholm and the women's suffrage movement. Ilchi personally liked First Lady Jill Biden's outfit and the message behind it. She wore a blue dress and coat by a young designer named Alexandra O'Neill, known for her sustainable practices to reduce waste. Ilchi says one of the more surprising fashion icons of this inauguration was Bernie Sanders in his mittens.
The mittens that he was wearing were made by a teacher with like recycled plastic bottles and other recycled material, and he's worn them before, so at least he did kind of convey a message in a way with his look.
Football fans will be glued to their TVs on Sunday watching the NFL Conference Championship games. The winners of those games will meet in Super Bowl 55 on February 7th. And for more, let's bring in Mike Pesca. He's Here and Now sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
So these games have some interesting storylines. Let's start with the NFC, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers against the Green Bay Packers. I hear these teams have two great quarterbacks.
Two well-known quarterbacks. Two quarterbacks with big followings. Now, Green Bay's quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, is an MVP front runner, I would say. Maybe he'll be the MVP. Such a great quarterback. He has a Super Bowl under his belt. He's at home. He has a great wide receiving core. He knows how to use his offense to great effect. And then on the opposite side is the Tampa Bay Buccaneer quarterback, Tom Brady. Now, Tom Brady, of course, is not known as being a Tampa Bay Buccaneer quarterback, the New England Patriots quarterback. And he came in there and sort of remade the whole offense. He picked it. They had good offensive weapons, but he got his tight end, Rob Gronkowski, down there. He put in, he had a lot of influence about how the offense was structured. And so what we're watching is not just a man in his 40s executing an offense. We're watching something of an architect. And between the two bays, Green and Tampa, I don't know who has the advantage.
Oh, an architect. You know, I know people in New England feel a lot of love for Brady. Is it going to be hard for fans of the Patriots to see him potentially win another Super Bowl for another team?
I don't know, because I think that there is definitely a split opinion among Bostonians, and we all know this because there are a lot of loud Bostonians letting us know their opinions. But there are some people who feel that Tom Brady gave so much and will always have all those Super Bowls with him, and the fit wasn't right in his last few years, and Bill Belichick didn't want to retain his services. So good for him. He could go and have one last hurrah with the beloved Gronk, if that happens. On the other hand, there are a bunch of Patriots fans who say, you know, in the last year, was Brady really giving 100% to this franchise? Maybe this will be a referendum on who is the more important piece, Belichick or Brady. I think it's really silly conversation. They were both so integral to each other's success. So that'll play out there as well.
Interesting. Okay, in another game, the AFC Championship, the defending Super Bowl winners, the Kansas City Chiefs, will play the Buffalo Bills. But there's some uncertainty about a quarterback, Kansas City quarterback Patrick Mahomes. What's the status?
Right. So remember when I said maybe Aaron Rodgers was a front runner for MVP? If not, it would be Patrick Mahomes, a magician with the football. But he was probably concussed. He is in the concussion protocols. There is some debate or discussion over if he had a concussion or some other something else hit him when he was hit and knocked out of the game last week. But the Chiefs are saying that he is likely to play. And with his arm, with his eyes, with his vision, with his ability to execute throws and plays that no one else has, no one else in the world, I would say that his presence would make Kansas City a favorite to go back to the Super Bowl and probably win it again.
Right, because he's the most valuable player. I mean, but a concussion is serious. Do you think they can really win this game on Sunday if he doesn't play?
If he doesn't play, I don't know. They have a great offensive coach and coordinator. Andy Reid is a great coach. The backup quarterback, Chad Henne, threw a bad interception in last week's game, but then he had a couple of really good throws. And their offensive weapons, I mean, they're all so fast and they have such clever plays. But no, I would say the drop-off to from Mahomes to Henne is as precipitous a drop as you could conceive of in the NFL.
Okay. The Buffalo Bills are a good story. They won the AFC East for the first time since 1995, but the Bills fans won't be nervous if they make it to the Super Bowl. I mean, won't they be nervous, I would say?
Yes. Well, of course, because a Buffalo Bills team in the Super Bowl has historically meant the Buffalo Bills will be losing the Super Bowl. And it's kind of unfair. I mean, they had four straight teams that made the Super Bowl. They lost one Super Bowl by a field goal, wide right. I know people in Buffalo are hearing that and they just, signed up for some trauma counseling afterwards. But I would say that's a great accomplishment. They, of course, you can't win a Super Bowl unless you get in a Super Bowl. So they're very excited for their team, their quarterback to make it back.
Okay, a lot of people are thinking about the entertainment. It's going to be a TV spectacle for the Super Bowl. R&B star Jasmine Sullivan and country singer Eric Church will join forces to sing the national anthem. Grammy-winning singer Her will perform America's Beautiful, and The Weeknd will perform during the halftime show. I guess at least there's a winter distraction as we deal with this pandemic.
Yeah, and if the Buccaneers make it, it'll be their home field. That's not happened before.
That's not happened before. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.